Amen. And kids, if you're kindergarten through second grade and making your way to story time in the library, and then kids third and older, make sure you grab the bulletin that you can fill out and follow along. And we're going through the book of Hebrews, and we're going to be in chapter 7. We're going to focus zero in on verses 1 through 10, but taking a big picture look, the section we're in is chapter 4, 14 through 10, looking at chapter 7, 1 through 10. And the year is 1902, and Cassie Chadwick is the talk of the town. The Cleveland Examiner says she is the envy of all the socialites. So the women envy her, the men desire her, and everybody wants her at their social gatherings. And then within a couple short years, her life would change drastically. By 1904, she would be embroiled in one of the largest trial scandals in the country. And then several years later, she'd commit suicide in prison. And as a result of, she would kind of perpetuate one of the largest frauds in U.S. banking history. Now, Cassie Chadwick wasn't her real name. Her real name was Elizabeth Bigley, and she was originally a Canadian, and she came down across the border and sort of realizing how gullible some of these Americans were, as she would pose as a wife of kind of these big-time bankers and would ingratiate herself and would kind of con people out of money. And then her kind of most famous con, the one that she got put on trial for, is she secured over $2 million in 1897 from local banks in Cleveland, which is the equivalent of a little over $60 million now. And her ruse was that she was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. And so she would go and take out loans in his name in the local banks. And kind of the way she set it up is you could go to his house in New York, and when the family wasn't home, they would give tours of the house. And so she would go and then subtly steal things from the house, steal stationery, steal photos, steal things, and then she would take the stationery and the things, and then she would make like forged documents and then create these documents that would say, it was like a letter from dad promising her that, she would inherit this amount of money. And then she would use that at the banks in Cleveland and used the money she borrowed to live this lavish lifestyle, and then it just snowballed. But then eventually one of the bank managers got suspicious and contacted Carnegie, and he heard wind about his daughter causing a ruckus in Cleveland and thought it was strange because he didn't have a daughter by that name, and then showed up one day, and then, as they say, it hit the fan, and then it turned into a nationwide scandal. And, she was trafficking on his name and then pretending to be a part of the family. And what we're going to look at this week is we're looking at chapter 7 in Hebrews. And in this section, one of the questions, one of the real issues in the section is what gives Jesus the right, his credentials, to be the high priest? And so one of the real challenges for those in the Jewish audience is, what gives him the right to be the high priest? What are his credentials? Is he a legitimate heir to these claims? One of the central claims of the book of Hebrews, and you see it in chapter 8, verse 1, he says, what I'm saying is this, we have this great heavenly high priest who's gone before us in the heavens. Now the big question is, all right, what are his credentials to be this heavenly high priest? Now, we have to remember that I think Hebrews came to an audience. It was written, it was given, it was a sermon. It was given to an audience probably in Rome in about late 50s, early 60s. And everybody in Rome, so either if you're a Roman or you were Jewish, you would have had a certain hang-up with the message. There were certain things that would have been hard for you to believe. And about a month or two ago, we set up some of the difficulties that the Romans would have had, because the book opens, it begins with this soaring, just almost unbelievable exaltation about who Jesus is, that he is the heir of all things, and that through him, God has created all things, and he's the exact representation of the living God, and he has been exalted, and he is seated at the right hand of his majesty on high. And you got to understand how strange that would have been for a Roman to hear, that he is ruling and reigning over all things. And kind of the way I set it up and framed it, if you remember, is I brought you into a sibling dispute from about a year and a half ago between our preteen girls and our five and six-year-old boys that got inflamed one Sunday when we were leaving church, and the girls wanted to listen to Taylor Swift, and the boys revolted because they did not want to listen to Taylor Swift. And I said, no Taylor Swift on Sunday. On Sunday, we only listen to Mommy. And that started a battle between who's a better singer, Mommy or Taylor Swift. And I wasn't quite prepared for the energy and the intensity of the sides that were drawn. And the boys became vehement and almost violent. So they were team Mommy. And then the girls were having to defend. And it was kind of humorous because a lot of people joined sides with the boys. And they also were team Mommy. But we're setting up kind of like that's how the Romans would have heard these celebrations of Jesus. Kind of like listening to the boys, like, oh, like, that's cute. That's sweet that you think your Jewish rabbi was all of these things. And I'm sure he's wonderful. Like, I'm sure his stories were funny. I'm sure he was a good teacher. I'm sure he made you feel like you were the only one in the room. But you mean to tell me your Jewish rabbi is, like, exalted over our Caesar? Come on. And so the Romans would have had a hard time hearing this message. But so would the Jews would have had a hard time. And part of their hang-up would have been, wait, you're telling me that Jesus is our great high priest? Well, there's one big problem with that. He is not in Aaron's family. He's an imposter. He's not a part of this family. So one of the things that the writer of Hebrews is going to go out of his way to say, there is precedent for this. He is not in Aaron's family, but he's in another priestly line. So he's going to unpack that. So that's what we're going to look at today. That's why he spends so much time unpacking that. We're going to be in Hebrews 7 this week and next week. So join me as we look. Let's look at verse 1 through, or the kind of the whole picture. He's going to tell them, all right, this is good news. That Jesus is in the order of Melchizedek. He's going to spend a lot of time here. So look in verse 1 through 10. For this Melchizedek, the king of Salem, the priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned the tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness. Then he is also king of Salem. He is king of peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God. He continues, a priest forever. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly offering have a commandment in the law to take the tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also were descendants from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him, who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, pays tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. So chapter 7 is going to kind of set this whole thing up. Why does it matter that Jesus is in the order of Melchizedek? And that's something that he's kind of repeated all throughout this whole section. Like you see in chapter 5, he is a priest forever, verse 6, in the order of Melchizedek. Chapter 5, verse 10, he's a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Chapter 6, verse 20, he is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Chapter 7, verse 11, he's the priest after the order of Melchizedek. Verse 17, you're a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So he's repeated over and over. He wants them to know that he's in this order. And now the question is, why? Why does he continue to beat that drum, to hit that note? So that's what we're going to try and unpack today. And so when we talk about, all right, what are Jesus' credentials to be our high priest? There's three that he lays out. He says, all right, he's in this order of Melchizedek. God has promised him this priesthood, and then he's still alive. So those are his three big reasons why He is credentialed to be our high priest. We're going to look at that first one today, and then next week we're going to unpack the fact he's still alive. So let's think about, all right, what does it mean that he's in the order of Melchizedek? And that's what he unpacks here. So you can kind of follow along if you have your outline. First thing, it means there's a precedent for a royal priesthood. So verses 1 through 3, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham. He's talking about a scene that happened to Abraham in Genesis 14. So he's taking him back to this episode in Abraham's life where Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, blessed him. So the situation is some kings in Sodom and Gomorrah kidnapped Abraham's nephew Lot and a significant number of other people. Abraham goes, he rescues him, he brings him back, and then Melchizedek comes, and then Abraham offers part of the spoil from the battle as a tithe, an offering to Melchizedek. So Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him, and to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He, Melchizedek, is first by translation of his name. So here we're going to get his name, King of Righteousness. Then he is King of Salem, and he is King of Peace. So the first thing he's doing is, all right, the reason this is good news that he's in this order of Melchizedek is because he's both king and he's priest. So there's precedent for a royal priesthood. This is one of the big hang-ups for Jesus's messianic kind of, not ministry, but for them to trust, to believe that he is the Messiah. Well, wait a second. How can he be both priest and king? We need two people, but he's just one. How can he be both of those things? And one of the arguments is, well, there's precedent for characters who can play both roles. He is both king and he is both priest. He is royal and religious. He is authorized to execute justice over God's enemies and also enter into God's sanctuary. He's the one who will bring God's victory, and he's the one who represents God's presence, triumph, and then communion. Notice just interesting little phrase, he is priest of the Most High God. It's an interesting phrase that is only used when Gentiles talk about Yahweh, the Most High. Melchizedek uses it, Balaam uses it, Isaiah uses it to talk about the nations, how they are to bow down to the Most High God. And so he is the priest. And then notice it gives these three different names. He's King of Righteousness, King of Salem, King of Peace. And these are things that Jesus takes upon himself. So King of Righteousness. Now, I don't know what you think about when you hear the word righteousness. If you think of that as good news, I think often when we think of King of Righteousness, we think of it as like self-righteous and not necessarily good news. Or maybe you think of the Righteous Brothers and You're My Soul and Heart's Inspiration comes to your mind. But what is righteousness? You know, a quick definition, righteousness, a biblical definition of righteousness is in line with God's design. So in line with God's design. So biblical principles, there's righteousness and justice, and they're always kind of paired together. So what is righteous is what is in line with God's design, and justice is the act of bringing things back in line with God's design. So you just think about the world, the kind of the story of the world is that this is God's good world. It has been ruined by sin, is redeemed by the Son and being recreated by the Spirit. And under that God's good world, the way God created the world is he created the world good. And in that world, he created all these different spheres of life. And those spheres of life were created with different dynamics that if you follow kind of the order of those spheres, they were meant to flourish. So you have different spheres like marriage and family, the civic society and communities and business and arts and the sciences and education and church. And there's these different spheres, and they have their own kind of ordering, their own kind of logic, internal principles, divine design, and they were created. And righteousness is that they live according to that design. So two examples you think about. You think about, kind of the two hottest issues going today when you think about the election, two biggest ones, think abortion and the economy. So you think, all right, well, what is righteousness when we think about, like, reproduction? And then what is righteousness when we think about work, the economy? What does righteousness look like there? What was God's design for reproduction? You know, God's original design is for marriage, for family, that God has given us this beautiful gift in marriage that two become one, and then he's given this tremendous gift of our sexuality, that is this incredible gift where in many ways that is when we are most God-like, because the two become one, and then they in that can create another. And in that creation, you almost think if you phrased it in like a sci-fi movie, there is one portal, there's one gateway, there's one door where you can bring an immortal soul into this time-space continuum. And that is the womb of a woman. And the context of that is in the gift of marriage, where husband and wife become one, and then you bring another being through that portal into existence. I mean, it's almost unbelievable if you think about it. You think, all right, what's the divine design? So righteousness is that divine design, and justice means to order and protect that so that can happen. Or you think about like the economy, work, right? What is righteousness for work? So God's divine design is the most basic logic behind righteousness and work is you reap what you sow. So you plant and then you harvest. So it is unjust if you labor and then you do not enjoy the fruits of the labor. It's also unjust if you do not labor and you enjoy the fruits of the labor. So both of those are unjust. So part of what is righteousness? Righteousness is to bring these different spheres in line with God's design. And what it says is he is the king of righteousness. So even if we think about things like righteousness, think about things like justice, I think it's really important to start getting clear biblically, all right, what are we actually talking about? So he's the king of righteousness. Now he's also the king of Salem. Now it's interesting that Salem is a location that becomes Jerusalem. Jerusalem. He was the king of a location, a place. But he's also the king of peace. I don't know what you think about when you think of peace. Like, if it's just something like this calm, you know, peace, love, groovy vibes with some essential oils lifting up into the rafters. But you know, hear the word. If you've been around church anytime, you probably heard this word. This is shalom. This is wholeness. This is well-being. I mean, in one sense, this is the reason we don't need to apologize for God's vision of righteousness, because it's this that actually brings full flourishing, full wholeness. Like, if we followed the divine design and all of those fears, we would have a thing called paradise. Following God's divine design and all of his fears brings this thing called utopia. But it's God's good world, and what ruins it is this thing called sin. That's what has ruined and broken it. We ignore these things to our own peril. Even just the basic things like God's divine design for the family. There's so many of our social ills that can be taken back to the breakdown of the family. Like, have you heard about the success sequence? Like, it's been shown in America that it's something like somewhere in the neighborhood of 96 to 98% of people can get out of poverty if you follow a basic sequence of graduate high school, get a job, get married, then have a child. So if you follow that sequence, and so very basic ordering. You know, I worked in a after-school program when I got out of college at the Benjamin Harvey Hills Homes in LaGrange, Georgia. And it was the largest housing project west of Atlanta. And I mean, I was completely incompetent and didn't do anything helpful there. But I had a guy who I work with who I love. He's this big, brawny black guy who used to play college football. And I just hear his voice in the back of my mind telling those boys. He would tell them, say, you know what? Adam got a job before he got a woman. So boys, get you a job before you get a woman. Trying to get you get on the success sequence. Follow the path. And so this is how peace comes. And the peace that comes, in one sense, there's a fourfold brokenness when sin came into the world. How did it break us? First, it broke us internally. It broke our relationship with God. Then we become broken internally, break our relationship with one another, and then the world. And then the peace that he brings restores all of those in succession. It fixes our relationship with God, then ourselves, then one another, and then the world. And that's the peace that he brings. So when it talks about shalom, it's not just talking about the absence of any conflict, anxiety, or difficulty. He's talking about the full restoration of relational harmony with God, self, others, world. It's this full peace. And what it says is Melchizedek's name means he is the king of righteousness. He's the king of this place, Salem, and he's the king of peace. And what the writer of Hebrews is saying is what his name pointed to, Jesus is. He is these things. So that's what he is. That's what his name means. And then notice it picks up in verse 3. It also means that there's a precedent for a priesthood that's not based on Aaron's genealogy. Now, this is one of the strangest and more difficult verses in the Bible. It says, he is, talking about Melchizedek, is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. So, genealogies in the ancient world, I mean, genealogies were kind of like your resume. They were your identity card, your identity statement. They told you who you were, what you were allowed to do, whether or not you had the right to go to a bank in Cleveland and withdraw money on your father's name. And it says that he, Melchizedek, was without father or mother or genealogy. And so could just mean that he lacked any officially recognized identity that would disqualify him from any legal position that they would have recognized in that world, or position of leadership because of his family or society. It says he has no beginning or no ending. Now, it could just mean that they have no record of his beginning or ending. And then it said he continues as a priest forever. And I'm not really sure what that means. And so somebody asked me last week, all right, does that mean this is like a pre-incarnate theophany of Jesus? And I don't know. I wanted to dive into this a little more this week, and Cynthia was out of town, and so I'll blame having to watch the boys on why I have less of an opinion than I wanted to. So we'll have to wait. But this is a strange verse, and so I'm not sure. At the bare minimum, what it means is there's precedent because Melchizedek didn't have all of those credentials that they were looking for, so Jesus doesn't have to have them either. And at the bare minimum, what it's doing is tackling one of the major defeater beliefs that their community had, and saying, all right, so in that world, one of the major defeater beliefs they would have had was, well, hey, Jesus can't be the high priest because he's not from Aaron's line. And the response is, no, he doesn't have to be because he's in a different caste. He's in a different priestly order, and there's precedent for that. And so it is worth just thinking about what's a defeater belief. This terminology, kind of Tim Keller popularized it in his book, The Reason for God. And he says, you know, every culture has some common sense assumptions that everybody just kind of knows that seems to make the gospel implausible to them. And so in this first century world, they would have just assumed, well, Jesus can't be the high priest. He's not one of Aaron's sons. Now, we hear that and think, oh, that doesn't make any sense. Why is that a difficulty? But it really was to them. But we ought to have somewhat epistemic humility, because they would hear some of our difficulties now and say, like, what are you talking about? Why is that hard to believe? For example, you know, if you go to, like in our current culture, like the biblical sexual ethic is really hard for us to people in the modern West to swallow. But if you go to other parts of the world, that's not hard for them to swallow at all. It's the most obvious thing. But you know what's crazy? Like, you go to the Middle East, and what's crazy is that Jesus says to turn the other cheek. I say, man, that's crazy. I've gotten into the show Shogun, and it really intrigued me about the missionary expansion into Japan in the 15, 1600s. And I was intrigued to learn that the Taiko, the leader of Japan, before this scenario happened, when the Jesuits first made inroads into Japan, there was a brief moment where the Taiko was on the verge of converting and then mandating the whole country convert too. And he sent a letter to the Pope and said he would be willing to convert, but there was two hang-ups that he had, and wanted to know if the Pope, if he would scratch out of the Ten Commandments, he wanted him to, his request was to scratch out of the Ten Commandments, you shall not murder. He thought that was ridiculous. How could you maintain a society if you couldn't murder? And then wanted to scratch out Jesus' command to love your enemies. So just scratch out those two, and I'll convert and all of Japan with me. And the Pope said, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And so that was like a defeater belief. He said, nope, you know, that's just crazy. And they're saying, all right, Jesus can't be our high priest because he's not in the line of Aaron. And the answer, well, he's in the line of Melchizedek. And it just should give us some humility to say, all right, our objections may not be as big as we think they are. And there are some answers for them. And then he goes on to this next thing that can seem strange to us, because he goes back and forth about this story about Abraham paying tithes to Melchizedek. So what's that all about? Abraham came, and then over and over it says he tithed to him, he gave him a tenth, back and forth in 4 through 10. And what that means is there's precedent for a priesthood that even Abraham saw as superior. So this also would have been a shock to them. See, this interaction between Abraham and Melchizedek, where Abraham is giving Melchizedek a tithe of his battle spoils, and then Melchizedek is blessing Abraham in God's name, is showing that Abraham is rightly recognizing, and here's the technical term, Melchizedek has mediatorial superiority over Abraham. So Abraham is recognizing that Melchizedek holds a higher place than he does, and Melchizedek actually represents God to Abraham, and so he is giving a tithe to him. And so the writer of Hebrews is saying the proper deduction is all of you who are children of, if Abraham, your father, in essence, bowed down to Melchizedek, then you who are Abraham's children should do the same to the one who's in his line. Now, a couple notes just about what he gave. It's interesting, the tithe. That's the 10%. That's where we get that from, what we give. You know, it's called the tenth. In essence, the tithe was kind of considered rent, their rent to God for living in the land. It was a tenth of all the agricultural produce or the livestock. It's part of kind of this blessing cycle. Did you notice this blessing? Abraham gives to Melchizedek the tenth, and then he gives blessings. So there's this cycle. God blesses them in the land. They return to God a portion of what he's blessed them with. And then the blessing comes back. It's kind of this generative cycle. It's interesting, this tenth and the tithe is for the worship of God, so that God's worship is maintained and held. So it's establishing the priesthood. So in this whole section, the point is that Jesus is establishing this priesthood. Now, why does the priesthood need to be established? So what he's doing here is he's reminding them that this institution, it's really important that Melchizedek Jesus is in this line because he's establishing this eternal priesthood because it's answering a problem that we can't solve. You know, it's kind of teasing in the men's Bible study. You know, I don't know, you know, he spends so much time talking about Melchizedek. And here's the question. I don't know if that was something that was just burning on, like, in their minds. Where, you know, as a pastor, you think, all right, why do you spend so much time talking about that? Is it because people are asking you? And so you really need to speak about this? Or are you talking about something nobody's asking, but you think it's really important? And so I don't know which it was here. If the people in this church are just talking about him all the time, and he's like, I got to put this in proper perspective for you. Or nobody's talking about it, and he's like, what you really need to know about is this. But he's establishing that the priesthood is an answer to a problem that we can't solve. It's how can a sinful, impure people who are not right enter into God's presence? You know, he is the king of righteousness, and being righteous, what righteousness is being right in his sight. And the big problem is we're not right in his sight. How can we be made right in his sight? And the beautiful thing about Jesus' priesthood is he gives what he is. He is the king of righteousness, and then he gives his righteousness. He is the king of peace, and then he gives his peace. And so he who knew no sin doesn't just forgive sin, but he became sin. So not that we can just know righteousness, but we actually become his righteousness. And so now we're not just declared righteousness, we become it. So now we are right in his sight, not because we do it or perform it, but because he declares it. And because we are in him. And so now our most fundamental identity is that in him, we are right in his sight. And then he gives, Paul says that his blood is our peace. And that peace, as king, he is king of peace. And his peace is not some wishy-washy, soft, marshmallowy type thing. It's something that's potent and it's powerful. I love how Paul talks about in the Philippians where he says that the peace of God will come and guard, like a Roman centurion who sets guard over your heart, and he comes with power. So what he is, he gives. He gives freely from his grace. He is righteous, and he gives it. He is peace, and he gives it. So how does he give it? How does he give righteousness? How does he give peace? You know, I think about one way I got to see this in a beautiful, dramatic fashion. It was a youth minister at a church in LaGrange. It was same place. I was working in the housing projects, and at our church, we had a wonderful, sweet, godly family. and they had three, you know, wonderful daughters, and the husband was worked in the school system, and he had the opportunity. It was about 5 years from retiring, but had this opportunity to get a job in a town that was about 3 or 4 hours away. But it was one of those kind of calculations where it's like, all right, well, I can take this job and do it for 3 years, but then I'll be able to retire early. And so it's kind of, I'll be away from the family for 3 years, but this will set us up so we can retire early and then, you know, kind of ride off in the sunset. And so he was away from his family, and it was kind of sweet because they had this big giant, you know, it's like a 3-year chart. You know, it looked like first graders with the chart counting down the days of school being over, had this giant chart. And every, you know, Sunday I'd see the mother, and her name is Mrs. Richburg, and I'd say, you know, how's Harry doing? And, oh, he's great. Only 752 days left. You know, how's he doing? Oh, he's great. Only 698 days left. I mean, just charting them down. And then sometimes he could come home on Saturday, but always had to leave like Sunday night. And just kind of tragically, with about 32 days to go, roughly, he unexpectedly had a massive heart attack and died in his bed on a Saturday night. And I remember kind of walking with her just through that grief and going through the highs and the lows of grief. And her refrain over and over and over was, "He's not against me. He's not against me." And she used to just use that refrain when all of Satan's temptations would come to despair and anguish and anxiety. And why would you let this happen? Why would you take him away even when he was alive and he wasn't here in those last moments? Why would we get so close and we'd have this hope? And then why would you take him then? She would remind, "He's not against me." And what I got to see up close and personal was someone who could take the peace of God that would stand like a strong sentry around her heart and guard her from all of the accusations. Because he is a king of peace, a mighty warrior who can protect you in those times. What he is, he gives. And one of the beautiful ways we see that and can experience that every single week is in communion. Because when we come to the table, what he is he gives, and he's giving us a living, tangible demonstration of his body and his blood so we can receive it. So here at Trinity, we come and we have 4 different stations. The one in the back corner will be gluten-free. And I'm going to pray, and then once our servers are in place, you come. So, Lord, we thank you that you are King of righteousness and King of peace. So I pray that if anyone in here that needs to know your righteousness, that they would come and know it. If anyone needs to experience your strong and mighty peace, needs to be protected from falsehood, that you would protect them. Needs to be protected from lies, that you would protect them. Needs to be protected from things that would unsettle or disrupt, that you would protect. And we thank you that you give who you are. So we ask now that you help us to receive you freely, receive you openly, receive you joyfully. And all this we ask in Christ's holy name. Amen.